Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 781, November the 24th, 1986. I was listening to the broadcasting this morning on CNN of the hearings in Congress regarding the Iranian affair. And as they announced, not since Watergate, not since Vietnam, has there been such outright criticism of the president, and they went into the fact of the National Security Council being separate from the State Department, keeping them in the dark, making their own policies. And remember, the reason this is coming to a head now, and we're lucky it's coming to a head, is that even during Watergate and Vietnam, the National Security Council was never taken apart. It was never threatened. It developed more and more muscle. The investigators never touched it until they get rid of it and defined it and limited it. It will continue to have the power it has over this country. Before I go into the national security, I quickly want to remind you of the broadcast I did on Cameroon, the explosions there, the mystery gas. I did three broadcasts, September 1st, 8th, and 15th, on the explosions in Cameroon when 1,800 people died. And I believe that was a testing between the United States Defense Department and Israel of the neutron bomb. And weeks after the broadcast that I had, 2.5 weeks afterwards, the London Times carried a large article about the fact that Israel had nuclear capability, nuclear arsenal, and that it also had the ability to make the neutron bomb. In the past 2 weeks, I have 18 articles on Israel, on Mordecai Vanunu, the scientist who left Israel with the pictures of the factories where the bombs are made. These articles are from the New York Times, Washington Post, San Francisco Examiner, Houston Post, People's World, Honolulu Star Bulletin, New York Times, and so forth, about Mr. Vanunu being taken back to Israel. He's going to face trial there for treason, but none of them mention the neutron bomb. They talk about the atomic bomb. Now, the San Francisco Examiner had just a short article. You can't even call it an article. It's one of those two tiny paragraph things, October the 5th, following the London Times story titled British N-Bombs Reported, Israel's been producing nuclear warheads for the past 20 years. And the article cites Mordecai Vanunu, identified as a former nuclear technician who claimed that Israel had produced a neutron bomb. And in the American press, as far as the articles I've seen, and many of you send me articles on various matters, if you see the mention of Vanunu, his trial in Israel, or any mention of the neutron bomb, send me a copy of the article or the article. Only in the San Francisco Examiner did it reprint that part that came from the London Times. Now, the London Times, a month later, has an article on Israel's problems with the exposures of the nuclear capability, and that they're moving somebody who was in charge of Vanunu security out of his job because they didn't see how he allowed him to have such a high position or take so many pictures of the plant. And the London Times says, despite a series of interviews questioning his behavior and contacts, Vanunu was able not only to gather comprehensive details about plutonium extraction and manufacture of advanced thermonuclear materials like lithium-6 and tritium used almost exclusively for the hydrogen and neutron bomb. Now, in the book The Global Manipulators, which is about the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission, is written by Robert Erringer. He cites in his book on page 66-67 not only concerns that Jimmy Carter had for the National Security Council as he went in for president, that the Georgia Mafia around him, Hamilton Jordan, Jody Powell, and others were deeply distressed in Carter's involvement with Zbigniew Brzezinski. And in fact, this book goes on, in the midst of the campaign, Jordan had said to the press, if after the inauguration you find Cyrus Vance as Secretary of State and Zbigniew Brzezinski as head of the National Security Council, then I would have said we failed and I quit. And he realized that to have two of those would destroy anything that Jimmy Carter had, whatever he had in mind. Now, later, towards the end of the administration, Cyrus Vance did quit. And the National Security Council running the White House has been going on ever since John and Robert Kennedy were murdered and the decisions then were put in the hands of Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, and then carried on through Sven Kramer's liaison to Ronald Reagan and so forth. with their admirals and lieutenant colonels operating the National Security Council. And in that regards of the Trilateral Commission and Jimmy Carter, Erringer wrote that Carter whirled a full 180 degrees on advice from his trilateralists when in April 1978, he made the controversial decision not to deploy the neutron bomb for NATO forces. I guess it has to be made to decide not to deploy it, but he says it would not be deployed, and this was in 1978. And this book cites an article in Newsweek, April 17, 1978, denouncing Jimmy Carter as elusive, contradictory, as exasperating as ever, because he was bent on proving that he didn't want the neutron bomb, and this disappointed his friends and would help our enemies. Now, the present head of NATO now is Lord Carrington. He's on the board and co-partner with Henry Kissinger of Kissinger Associates. Alexander Haig, their protege, was out pumping for the neutron bomb in 1981, as soon as Ronald Reagan was president. Mr. Casey of the CIA was pushing Haig out to encourage our allies to receive shipments and deployments of the neutron bomb. So Casey and Haig and Carrington of NATO, and with Henry Kissinger making the policies today in and out of the various agencies, it is not difficult to believe, with all of these people's long affiliations with the Mossad and Israel, and you see the links of the Carter administration from 1979-1980, sending weapons to Iran, to Khomeini, along with the Mossad and Israel, it is not hard to believe that this was, in fact, a test of the neutron bomb in Cameroon. The Soviet Union Pravda carried an article this week by Georgi Arbatov, A-R-B-A-T-O-V, director of the United States and Canada Institute. He said it is impossible to speak to Ronald Reagan. He's an untrustworthy ideologue. He's mouthing the Nazi propaganda of Joseph Goebbels, and he's using books that he borrowed from Goebbels for speeches that he is giving. They said he, since the summit, has become a rabid anti-Soviet, and the Kremlin can't trust his word anymore. And maybe they'll have no more dealings, the superpowers, until Reagan leaves office. Helmut Kohl of the Soviet Union was accusing Mr. Gorbachev of being like Nazi Goebbels, and Gorbachev responded instantly. And it literally said, just shut up. That's not true. And the United States is now being accused of our president using the books written by Joseph Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda, to break up any conferences of peace. And it seems impossible to have discussions as long as Ronald Reagan and the people behind him are in power. On the anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy, the media had their usual barrage. There was a movie on the television. I saw it. It was a 6-hour broadcast, 5 hours of witness testimony. The Monterey Herald had a story today that goes out from London and the Associated Press. Jury convicts Oswald in mock trial. A mock trial of a man accused of killing John Kennedy, shown Sunday night on British television. They convicted Oswald of murder 23 years after the assassination. The jury, in the television presence, upheld the prosecution's argument that there is no evidence to contradict the Warren Commission that Oswald is the lone assassin, and this docudrama, this 5.5-hour docudrama, was shown in this country where people were to decide on the innocence of Lee Harvey Oswald or his guilt. Now, prosecuting Lee Harvey Oswald in this two-part program was Vincent Bugliosi. He not only prosecuted the Manson family, which wasn't hard to do, given all the evidence and motley fingerprints and admission to the various murders by each of them, but he published a book called Helter Skelter. Helter Skelter is the name of a song written by the Beatles, and it is typical of disinformation or linkage and mind control to link the Beatles to those murders that were allegedly random, that I don't think were, writing Blood on the Door, Helter Skelter, to link the Beatles, the rock musician, the hippies at that time, to these horrible murders. So Bugliosi, who titled his book Helter Skelter, which is a masterpiece of disinformation anyway, was a prosecutor. Jerry Spence from Wyoming was the defense attorney for Lee Harvey Oswald. The assistance for this came from a writer in Texas who worked with Mary Farrell. Mary Farrell is the lady who holds court rain in Dallas, Texas, for people that come through there, the various researchers. When I was in Texas, Penn Jones told me not to see her. He thought she was part of the intelligence community. And she had Sylvia Maher over that evening, and they wanted me to come over. And I wouldn't see either one of them. I saw Sylvia Maher in New York City. She wrote the index of the Warren Commission hearings and left out the names of the people in Texas, particularly the most important that linked to Nazi Germany, to Munich Germany, a continuity from World War II onto where we're facing right now, these various characters that came from Munich and played a role in the murder of John Kennedy. Mary is close to Bernard Fensterwald, the CIA attorney who represented James McCord during the Watergate saga, and also Marianne Paisley, who was in charge of the Soviet desk, whose husband would be overly Harvey Oswald of Navy intelligence when Oswald was in the Soviet Union. And Mary is close to Gordon Novell, the character that Jim Garrison wanted in New Orleans, for his association and role with people involved in the murder of Kennedy. Gordon Novell is currently the control officer of John DeLorean, and those are very close friends of Mary Farrell. So that's the group that made the movie. Now, in the 5 hours, they had 21 to 24 witnesses, and that's the equivalent in 5 hours is one day in court. You get to court, and they'd all been sworn in. If you go to a murder trial of a court, if you come in at 9 in the morning, it closes at 4. So this trial had 5 hours of witness testimony of 24 at the most, 21 and 24 witnesses, and then you were supposed to vote. That's one day in court. The Warren Commission had 26 volumes of affidavits and exhibits. They had 552 witnesses. They had about 70 witnesses that should have been called, and many sitting in the room that should have been called with no cross-examination, and mentioned other persons involved. And so the after the 23rd anniversary, you're supposed to know in 5 hours, with these people streaming through, that Oswald positively did it. And then to ice that juicy cake, they had three people, authorities on the subject, telling you their opinion of the verdict, what it should be, while you're supposed to call in and say whether Oswald's guilty or not. And Jack Anderson is there saying that Fidel Castro had John Kennedy murdered, and that mafia figure John Rosselli told him that Castro did it, and that's why Rosselli was murdered. Rosselli was murdered at the same time that the House Select Committee on Assassinations was working. He was murdered at the same time George de Morenschild, Oswald's closest Defense Department agent, was murdered. He was murdered the same time that Carlos Prio Siqueiras, the former president of Cuba, who had a role in all of this, was murdered. And Rosselli was killed when he testified before the House Select Committee and gave some information about the assassination. Not that he talked to Jack Anderson, but they had other information. And then his buddy, who was supposed to testify, Sam Giancana, was murdered. And William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI, very instrumental in this whole operation, he was murdered. And Gary Powers, who flew the U-2 plane and suggested Oswald had a role in the Soviet Union of downing that, he was killed in a plane crash just over Santa Barbara. And there were a whole series of murders of people, you know, at the time that Rosselli died. So Jack Anderson is saying Rosselli told him Castro did it. That's so convenient. Then Ramsey Clark, who was former attorney general, gets on the big wide screen and says, yes, Oswald did it. Well, Martin Luther King was killed in April, early April 1968, and Ramsey Clark was the attorney general, and he went immediately on TV and with the printed media news conferences that James Earl Ray did it alone. And when James Earl Ray was picked up in June, just at the time of the Robert Kennedy assassination in June of 68. A few months later, they had a suspect who had left Memphis, Tennessee, and gone all the way to London and Portugal and back to London. And on the basis of the House Select Committee on Assassination saying there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, and Ramsey Clark, the attorney general, saying he did it alone, he shouldn't even be on the television. So you see how slanted it was to have a man who's a proven liar talking on the television about Lee Harvey Oswald. And then they had Alan Dershowitz from Harvard, who said that he made certain points that were good about evidence being destroyed, and you can't come to a positive conclusion, actually, when evidentiary matter is destroyed, that you can't prove facts if you don't have evidence. But on the other hand, Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone. So that is the 23rd anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, and now they don't have to make a new one next year. They can bring this out every year, and you can rest assured they will. The San Francisco Chronicle had a story this week apropos of the Kennedy murder, the botched trial of Jack Ruby. And this tells about the prejudicial trial and how bad Judge Brown was, and that Ruby's lawyers asked for a new trial. And the article says Ruby's lawyers cataloged the laundry list of errors that the trial judge had committed and effectively recreated the atmosphere of hate that pervaded in the Dallas jail during the trial. Even the conservative court saw the manifest injustice of forcing Ruby to stand trial in Dallas on October 5, 1966. They unanimously overturned his conviction and his death sentence. It took presiding judge W.A. Morrison 10 succinct paragraphs to hold that Ruby's confession was not spontaneously made, that it should be excluded. So they set a date for the new trial. The new trial, the appeals court ordered, was to be held in North Texas town of Wichita Falls in the spring of 1967. 3 months after Ruby won his appeal for a new trial, he died at Parkland Hospital. And so that was just 3 months before he could open his mouth, and he was talking about the Nazis and the fascists in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now, with regards to the Kennedy assassination, Freedom Magazine, this last issue, December 86, had a short article, or a, I guess you'd call it an editorial, by Jim Garrison, the renowned district attorney. He lives in New Orleans. He's a judge now at the present time, who had the courage to open up the Kennedy assassination saga and arrest Clay Shaw, and all the CIA and Defense Department came down on him and forced the case not to be solved, and Clay Shaw was legally declared innocent. But Jim Garrison has worked on this case and is the only person I know from that standpoint who has gone extensively into the far-right Nazi fascist links of Clay Shaw and the intent purposes of killing John Kennedy and the motives for doing it. I want to share with you what he said in Freedom, because some of you don't get the magazine, and it is pertinent to the National Security Council, which is a matter I'm going on to in a few moments and detail with you. I was going into the Philippine money connections, but because of the hearings on the National Security Council, I'll use that material today. Jim Garrison said, "If we are to understand and bring under control the forces which are shaping today's America and are endeavoring to shape our future, we cannot rest with the official version of the killing of John Kennedy. If we cannot have the truth once and for all about the government's murder of John Kennedy, if the warfare interests in our government are so powerful that they cannot be questioned about such things, then let us have an end to the pretense that it is a government by the people. If the American people choose to do nothing about what it was done to John Kennedy and about the subtle conversion of their country from a democracy into a thinly disguised version of the warfare state, then the republic is lost and we shall never see it again in our time." And keep in mind what I was saying, the article in Pravda this week about the United States being impossibly tilted towards war and warmongering to the extent of using the speeches from Adolf Hitler's persons. Garrison said, "In any event, we need no longer pretend there's any mystery left about the assassination of John Kennedy. The Cold War is the biggest business in America, worth hundreds of billions of dollars a year, as well as tremendous power to men in Washington. The president was murdered because he was genuinely seeking peace in a corrupt world. As tired as we are of the horror of the subject, all of us must address ourselves honestly to the meaning and implications of the assassination of Kennedy, or all of us will pay the price and live in tyranny. The killing of a president by a high level of government," and this, as I mentioned before, is the National Security Council, "in that highest level, is a coup d'etat. The coup d'etat is nearly unheard of in America. In European history, is replete with the elimination of national leaders by immediate subordinates. That is why the Europeans quickly sensed what was happening, and Americans showed virtually no comprehension whatsoever. Even the untimely reversal of Kennedy's policies in regard to Vietnam, while he was still laying in state at the Capitol, failed to generate the slightest spark of curiosity in the United States. A successful coup d'etat affects not merely the history of the nation, but may change its entire power structure. And as I'll cite in a few moments, the power that has gone to the national security since Kennedy is dead. He said, with the killing of John Kennedy, the very position of the presidency was drastically reduced in status. And I have to divert again to what's happening to Reagan now and the analysis of him just on the news these current days. Garrison said, henceforth, the president would be a broker for the war machine. He would be an advocate and spokesman for the Pentagon. All presidents who followed Kennedy would have to know their impotence, no matter what the public role. Until the work of the Kennedy assassination is undone, presidents will come and go, and the warfare machine and its extensive intelligence tentacles, domestic as well as foreign, remain in control. The assassination reduced the president of the United States to a transient official, a servant of the warfare conglomerate. His assignment is to speak as often as possible about the nation's desire for peace while he serves as a business agent in Congress for the military hardware and the manufacturing of the military. The assassination resulted in insulating people from the decision-making policies and the foreign policies of peace or war. And you see this separation of the policies of this national security from, digressing from Garrison, saying, the separation of the national security from the State Department, the Congress, and even the president sometimes, they were making the decisions, and some of those he wasn't even told for a while. Garrison said, prior to the assassination, in accordance with the Constitution, the president made decisions with regard to foreign policy, then the Senate approved or disapproved treaties, and then Congress decides whether or not we go to war. There were good reasons for the system. In each instance, the decision was made by men who were elected by the people. And these are not the Poindexters, North, and Singlaubs that you never see, or the Eagleburgs, or the Scowcrofts, or so forth. They're elected by the people. Garrison said the rifle shots in Dealey Plaza removed these vital powers from the elected officials and made them readily available to the warfare apparatus. As a result, after Kennedy almost... Although most Americans were opposed to the war in Asia, it went on and on. The foreign policy went on being that made by the Pentagon and by the Central Intelligence Agency. When a counter-revolution is occurring and a low-level intelligence employee is being prepared for sacrifice to draw attention away from the power elite, they are sponsoring a forthcoming assassination. It is perhaps old-fashioned to speak of the injustices being dealt to the scapegoat. Nevertheless, the observation has to be made that the inhumanity demonstrated by the CIA and the masked eminence for whom it performed was scarcely distinguishable from the inhumanity of the totalitarian governments we defeated in World War II. Actually, we had taken the place of the totalitarian powers who we defeated, and after our two decades as a superstate during the years of the Cold War, we became a different country. And it is those two decades I'll refer to later in some other articles. To be sure, Jim Garrison said, of all the revered symbols of America, they kept those to cover up what is happening, singing the Star Spangled Banner, the president throwing the first baseball season, reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in school. But changes had occurred in America. It happened as silently as the moon sliding behind the clouds. With the advent of our special brand of benevolent imperialism, we had acquired secret police, an integral part of the warfare state, secret police not only around the globe but within our own country as well. It was in the name of national security, but in the name of national security, the warfare state commits its worst crimes against humanity. What was important above all was that the newer power structure of our country is no longer the one originally contemplated by the Constitution. Lip service continued to be paid to the importance of the individual and his rights and the greatness of democracy and the leadership of the free world. However, the center of gravity of power in America has long since fallen into the control of the warfare interests, and all the signs of a free society which were still exhibited on every hand were garlands, tinseled ornaments to keep the populace happy. The real test of whether a country still belonged to the people was what happened to national leaders who called for an end of Vietnam War or removal of the troops from Asia. They were all shot to death by ostensibly lone assassins, men who every case had remarkable records of international travel. They were also given cancer and thrown out of buildings and dropped dead on the streets of poisoning to get rid of these particular people. John Kennedy was going to be executed because he was the one who stood in the way of the continued power of the superstate and continued growth of the empire. Oswald was executed promptly afterwards because somebody had to be seized and killed to turn the eyes of the people away, to halt at the very outset the beginning of thought. The singular value of intelligence employee as a scapegoat was the fact that such agents go where they are told. This is like get your job at the book depository or go to the airport and get your job there. Do what you're told, and you can easily be set up so as to appear to be a violent leftist assassin, like Lee Harvey Oswald handing out Marxist material for Cuba for Fidel Castro in front of the Trade Mart in New Orleans. Jim Garrison says that high government officials knowingly and using electronic media would do the rest, and a whole new chapter of history is written, created out of the purest gossamer fabric spun out of the trust of people and the duplicity of their leaders. It is 23 years since Kennedy was assassinated, and the model officially presented by the government has sagged and finally collapsed under the weight of its cumbersome lies. Nor is there any sign that the hope that succeeding administrations have any interest in seeing the truth or making it available. The fact that the same men continue to run the Pentagon, the CIA, and the FBI that helped to conceal the CIA's handiwork after the assassination indicates that the war-oriented interests are in firm control, and nothing more can be expected from this government except more untruths and war. Now, interestingly enough, while the jury of the Kennedy trial, the Oswald trial, was out, people could call in and say whether they or not they thought Lee Harvey Oswald was guilty or innocent. And in the East Coast and in the Midwest and on the West Coast, the tallies were almost identical. 85% to 86% of the people didn't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did the assassination alone, that he was involved with somebody else or didn't do it at all. But 85% to 86% was the national opinion on this story, which shows that that jury was using a handful of 24 at the most witnesses that were handpicked to present a weak case in 5 hours, and that people out at large are much smarter. Now, the secret or the important thing to do is to get activity to open up this case, the material that's locked up, and re-examine it without the old people re-examining again, without bringing in people like G. Robert Blakey and have real evidence on the table. Incidentally, speaking of covert actions and the way this country was overthrown, there's an article from the LA Times this morning on Corazon Aquino and her problems in the Philippines, and one of the political parties there, the National Democratic Front, is saying that these problems that she's having are developed by the imperialist conspiracy backed by the United States CIA. The plot, they asserted, was ultimately aimed at forcing Washington hardline counterinsurgency strategy on Corazon Aquino, and is proof they cited, Ocampo cited, the background of Ramos and Aledo, who are now running the military in the Philippines. They're both graduates of West Point. They served with the American Armed Forces, and they're both experts in psychological warfare. And just a few weeks ago, John Singlaub and his troop from the National Security Council were in the Philippines, which supports this statement. And I hoped I'd get to Singlaub in the Philippines today, but I will, I think, put that off until next week. Now, the Washington Post has a story today, the 24th of November, by Bob Woodward about our excuses for going into Iran and arming Iran, and how Ronald Reagan, again, using the advice of the National Security Council, had a new law, a secret intelligence law formed that gives the CIA authority to interfere in the affairs of a foreign government, the national security, which they're not supposed to do. And their purpose was to shape the behavior of Ayatollah Khomeini and his successor. So again, we're going into the mind control way of shaping the way they think in Iran, in the Philippines, and all over the world, based upon the expertise of those people from the National Security Council. The Woodward article says that the covert operations give the CIA and the National Security Council and the White House primary role in attempting to manage and develop U.S. foreign policies towards Iran or elsewhere. Informed sources describe CIA Director William Casey as a strong supporter of the covert plan involving paramilitary actions CIA support, such as with the Contras, traditionally done by our State Department and other agencies and Defense Department, being handled by the White House by the secret group of the National Security Council, who write new laws and give themselves new powers and then proceed to affect the mind and the psyche of the leaders and the military of these huge countries. So they're operating in a mind control as well as a military way inside this little office with a handful of people who aren't elected and not identified. They're identified now for the first time, but for the most part, they've kept themselves pretty secure. We'll take a one-minute break, and I want to go back to the National Security Council and Ronald Reagan and the problems that are happening right now.